I was a ex-drug addict, ex-gang member, ex-alcoholic, ex-convict, ex-everything. You know, I was involved. I've been involved in the streets since I was 8 years old. I've been in and out of jail. I mean, I'm 42 now, so I've been in and out of jail since I was a kid.
My dad, he been in and out of jail. You know, and then my stepdad, he was always beating on my mom, and, you know, one day I just knocked him down, and then after that, I never went back. Since I was 17, I've been in the street, do my own thing.
For me, to be a good dad is to be definitely a leader, a provider, someone that your child can speak to, and above all else, to keep it real with them, be true with them. You know, you got to let them know what's going on out there. You can't be sugarcoating nothing. You know, you got to let them know this is a tough world. You know what I'm saying? But you can make it softer by staying in school, following rules in society, not looking up to garbage on the corners or whatnot. You know what I mean? And just staying focused.
You know, my kids love me a lot because I take them to the park and we eat a lot of the same things. They like the things that I eat, even the spicy stuff. Yeah. So I see myself in my kids, and I also see myself in my dad.
When you do get that opportunity to get back with your kids and be a functioning dad, how will it be different for you?
Well, first and foremost, I know I won't be drunk or high, you know, or under the influence whatsoever. If anything, I'll be high off life just to have my kids with me. You know, my daughter, she's 9, you know. I see her once every other year, you know, and last time I seen her was around Halloween, around October. You know, that was the last time I seen her. And when I seen her, I she's getting tall, you know, and I just kind of like, I didn't believe she was there.
Stories of fathers, fatherhood, and the moments that shape our lives. It's Extension 720 on 720 WGN.
Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720.
Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. We welcome you again to Extension 720.
Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720. Hello to all. This is Milton Rosenberg.
We'll talk about that tonight on Extension 720.
Welcome to another Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I am Justin Kaufman. Thanks for joining us tonight. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Tonight on the program, stories loosely assembled around the theme of fatherhood. That could be for Father's Day, fatherhood, forefathers, or a full hour of covers of Father Figure by George Michael. It won't be, but it could be. I'm just saying it could be. That's what you like. As you just heard, we featured dads who are part of the Young Fathers Program at Metropolitan Family Services. We head down to their offices on the south side near 91st and Commercial. We'll talk about the program that's more than just an employment program, but one that supports young dads who want to strengthen their relationships with their kids. Also tonight, let's talk about dads and their roles in the family unit. We've heard a lot about the changing role of women, as moms are fast becoming the breadwinners in some families, yet still expected to care for the children. But what about dads? Are we pulling our weight as the family structure changes in 2019? Dr. Katie Gardner will join me to discuss that issue. Also tonight, the new indie film, The Last Man, Black Man in San Francisco, is hitting theaters this weekend. The creators and stars of this film, Joel Talbot and Jimmy Fails, will be in studio to talk about the brilliant film that explores gentrification, love, loss, and family. It's going to be a huge summer hit. You watch. Trust me on this one. An actor and comedian, Kel Mitchell, knows a thing or two about family and fatherhood. The Nickelodeon star has been on TV since he was a teenager. And now, a kid who will be forever known for his turn on Good Burger is a dad himself. Not necessarily the life and career the Southside native planned, but he'll take it. And this weekend is one of my favorite weekends for live music because it marks the return of Flamenco Passion. It's up at the North Shore Center for the Performing Arts, and the music and dance company Ensemble Español will be paying tribute to one of their forefathers, or in this case, four mothers, Dame Libby Camaico. The founder of the company died earlier this year, and we'll talk about her legacy and hear live music in studio coming up right after the break. That's all tonight on Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. So do stay with us. It's Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Before we get to any more of the show, I think it's time for a little flamenco, don't you?
Hola, my name is Jorge Perez, and I serve as the executive director of the Ensemble Español Spanish Dance Theater in residence at Northeastern Illinois University.
Hello, my name is Paco Fonta. I'm the flamenco singer and guitarist for Ensemble Español, and I'm going to be singing now Juan Sevillanas. Cartas iban y venían desde Londres a Madrid. Desde Londres a Madrid, cartas iban y venían desde Londres a Madrid. Loco estoy yo, vida mía, lo mismo que tú por mí. Lo mismo que tú por mí, en el Palacio de Oriente, todo risa y alegría. Doña Cristina sonríe a su hijo tan feliz. Qué bien parece, doña Victoria Eugenia, qué bien parece, doña Victoria Eugenia y Alfonso XIII. La historia de una amapola que escapó de entre los trigos. Que escapó de entre los trigos, la historia de una amapola, que escapó de entre los trigos, la historia de una amapola, que escapó de entre los trigos, que escapó de entre los trigos, dicen que la vio el almendro, dicen que la vio el olivo, dicen que la vio la luna por un claro en el camino. Al destaparle la cara con las luces de la aurora, dicen que ha visto el gentío en el rojo una pastora que es la Virgen del Rocío. Y a la puerta de Toledo, mare, le tengo celo. Le tengo celo. Y a la puerta de Toledo, mare, le tengo celo. A la puerta de Toledo, mare, le tengo celo. Le tengo celo. Porque se cita con otro la mujer que él más quiero. Porque se cita con otro la mujer que él más quiero. En el mismo sitio y a la misma hora, y a la misma hora se estaba besando con otra persona. Cara que es la tercera, que es la tercera, mira la cara, cara que es la tercera, mira la cara, cara que es la tercera, que es la tercera, ya verás con qué gracia te zapatea, ya verás con qué gracia te zapatea. Y esa gitana ya conquista bailando por sevillana. Cuando paso por el puente Triana contigo vida mía. Cuando paso por el puente Triana contigo vida mía. Triana contigo vida mía. De mirarte solamente Triana.
mañana me muero de alegría. Porque tienes unos ojos, Triana, igual que dos luceros, Triana, igual que dos luceros. Una clase de hechura, Triana, que va del montonero. Si por otro me dejaras, Triana, de pena moriría, cariño. Te quiero y te querré, eres mi norte y mi día, Triana, Triana, yo.
Sevillanas.
Hey, all right. Live music tonight from Paco Fanta, a flamenco guitarist, and also Jorge Perez, who was also the executive director of the Ensemble Español. He was on the castanets on that song. We'll hear more from them coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. They're part of the Flamenco Passion performances, which are at the North Shore Center for the Performing Arts in Skokie this weekend. More to come here on Extension 720. Stay with us.
Back to Justin Kaufman and Extension 720 on 720 WGN.
Talking Father's Day tonight, fatherhood. Coming up after the news, we're going to talk with the some of the program managers, the Young Fathers Program at Metropolitan Family Services. We went down to 91st Street to talk to some of the dads who take part in the program and also some of the program managers about the program that's happening on the South Side and all over the city. Also coming up a little bit later in the show, like I said, we're going to talk about the family unit structure of 2019 as more and more women are changing their roles and becoming breadwinners in the family and being asked to lean in. What are men doing? And Father's Day, I definitely want to have the conversation how we uplift and talk about men, but I also think we should be somewhat, we should at least have the conversation about whether or not men are changing their roles in the household. It may be one thing to help out with the kids, but you know, are you seeing dynamic changes in the way that the family structure is playing out in 2019? So we'll have that conversation coming up at 8 o'clock. Father's Day coming up this weekend. That's why we're doing the show, of course. It's our only show this week. White Sox are back tomorrow night. I'm program note. I'm in for a row Thursday and Friday. So tomorrow, Thursday and Friday. And Friday. Thursday, Friday. So that's from 3 to 7, 3 to 6:30, I think, before the pregame takes over. Then this weekend, I'm going up to, for Father's Day, I'm taking my son up to see my dad in Lake Geneva and in that area. And we are going to go fishing. Yeah, got the licenses and everything. And
Are you a fisherman?
No. Not. I grew up on Wonder Lake. So we did fishing there, and there's been a couple of fishing instances in my life, but not a fisherman, not by a long shot. I was confused. I needed a license. Mm-hmm. Why can't you just drop a line in? Old school.
What kind of bait you using?
I don't know. I'm hoping that there'll be a shack.
Yeah.
On the way.
Worms?
Yeah, we could pull over to the shack, and an old guy can spin a yarn, tell me about how this one lure is the one to get the pike, to get the muskie. We'll see. I don't know how long we're going to do it, probably till the whining starts. I'm talking about my whining, not my son, but me. Come on, let's go back. Come on, the NBA Finals are on. Something like that, right? I have a couple of funny fishing stories. If we have time throughout the show, I'll talk about in our lifetime. There's both times with my family that the fishing went horribly right or wrong. I mean, the fish got caught, but it was bigger than they thought. The pole was in the water, and tears were shed. It's a whole story. So we'll get to it coming up tonight. Next time, Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up a little bit later in the program, Kel Mitchell's going to join us from Nickelodeon, the sketch comedy show All That, The Revival, which is coming up this weekend, as well as his work with Good Burger and his partner Keenan Thompson for a long time. So we'll have that conversation coming up a little bit later in the show. And for those who text in saying that they wanted more flamenco music, that is coming up as well later in the show. More performance, that's coming up. So stay with us. Our first segment tonight focuses on the work of the Young Fathers Program from Metropolitan Family Services. The program has been around for a while now. It was first created to serve as an extension of an employment program, but it's gone way beyond that, helping young men in Chicago with everything from balancing a checkbook to maintaining healthy relationships. They work with the dads to understand their responsibilities, but to also recognize their impact on their children's lives. They help pay for field trips. They give the dads legal support to help with custody and child support issues. They help them with all sorts of life skills. The goal is to support the young father, but to keep that young father in their kids' lives. I went down to the 91st Street offices to hear from the program managers who helped make this program work. But first, let's hear from some of the dads that use the Young Fathers Program at Metropolitan Family Services. First up, Ivan. Ivan has two kids, one 22, one 8. Ivan has lived a life separated from his kids and separated from society. He's been in and out of jail his entire life, 16 times. He grew up on the streets without a father himself. So he's well aware of what impact that has on a child's life. Here's Ivan's story.
I was an ex-drug addict, ex-gang member, ex-alcoholic, ex-convict, ex-everything. You know, I've been involved in the streets since I was 8 years old. I've been in and out of jail. I mean, I'm 42 now. So I've been in and out of jail since I was a kid. The thing with my oldest son, he's in college right now. You know, and he goes to Champaign Urbana. And I've always kept it real true with him. Every time we spoke, I never sugarcoated nothing, because I never wanted him to be like, you know, oh, Dad, well, why you nothing? You know, I always told him everything about my past, my lifestyle, you know, and I also told him which two directions he can go. You know, you can take this route, which is education, school, academic-wise, and stuff like that, or you could try the street. You know, but whichever route you choose, it, you know, I'm gonna back you 150%. You know, so I never told him, hey, do this or do that.
Right.
I told him the choices that he had. You know, those are choices no one ever told me.
I was going to say, did you have that choice?
No, I didn't have that choice. No, my whole family was involved in gangs. You know, my mother sold, you know, drugs when I was real little. My aunt sold drugs. People, you know, my whole family was involved in street life. You know, so I truthfully, I mean, you know, there's people that, yeah, you could have did this or could have did that. I grew up on 26th Street. It's called Little Village.
Yeah.
Back then, everybody over there, grandmothers, grandfathers, everybody was involved in the gangs that were there. You know what I'm saying? And me, honestly speaking, right now, and I don't care who hears this, it was a cancer on our whole society. And it tore up a whole bunch of us. You know what I mean? I lost my sister to HIV. I just lost my older brother about 2 years ago from a cocaine crack overdose. My cousin Jessica, she's Jessica Flores, that's missing out there in Indiana. They still haven't found her body. That's my cousin. And, you know, I could just go on and on. Mm. You know what I mean? The horrors that these neighborhoods, you know what I mean, had done to not just my family, but dozens of other families.
A lot of what we talk about in here, and we talk with the program managers and the other dads, had to do with breaking the cycle.
Yeah.
Do you need it to be broken? I mean, thinking about how you grew up and the life around you.
Without no question. Yeah. I need it to be broken, without no question. You know what I'm saying? Not only for me, man, but for every kid that's out there.
What does it mean to be a good dad?
For me, to be a good dad is to be definitely a leader, a provider, someone that your child can speak to, and above all else, to keep it real with them, be true with them. You know, you got to let them know what's going on out there. You can't be sugarcoating nothing. You know, you got to let them know this is a tough world. You know what I'm saying? But you can make it softer by staying in school, following rules of society, not looking up to garbage on the corners or whatnot. You know what I mean? And just staying focused.
This program, and we talked about it, you know, really tries to put an emphasis on what it means to be a parent, not just a good parent, but, you know, beyond, to take good parents and make them great parents. And they talk about the fact that a lot of dads are missing in the generation just before, that this has been a scourge on our society, that men have just bounced.
Yeah.
So how do you see it? Do you see a resurgence of people getting more involved with their families and involved with their fatherhood as opposed to walking away?
I'll be honest with you. Through this program here, I've seen dozens of guys and met dozens of guys that actually are back in their kids' lives. Regardless, they even taught us about, even if you're at, you know, war, so to speak, with the mother, your child, not to let that dampen your relationship with your kid. You know what I'm saying? I grew up without a father, I mean. Who did I look up to after that? The guys on the corner, you know, the older guys, you know. So, I mean, it's a mission. You know, but if we don't have programs like this that's out there helping all the brothers out there and sisters and stuff to get their, you know what I'm saying, to basically kick off their train of thought, because that's what we need, something to provoke thought. You know, and programs like this is doing that. It's done it for me. And I've been in gangs, man, for like 33 years. And now I just like totally like I'm against it all the way.
You were 16 different prisons,
yeah.
Life on the street, yep. Drugs, alcohol, like you said. You get a second lease on life here.
Yeah.
And it gives you a second lease on being a parent, being a dad. So how are you going to do it differently now than say you were doing it before?
Now I'm going to definitely devote a lot of time with my kid, which I do. I'm always there with him. You know what I mean? Every single day I call him, I speak to him, ask him how's he doing, does he need anything? You know, and ask him, you know, is something bothering you? You know, talk to me. You know? And believe it or not, they open up a lot of times and let you know what's bothering them. So then we come out, instead of talking about the problem, we come and talk about the solution. What can we do about it? You know, how do we go about this? You know, and so forth.
It's Ivan on being a dad and being part of the Young Fathers Program at Metropolitan Family Services. Next up, Hector. Hector has three kids, and he rarely gets to see them. But he holds them close. He has their names tattooed on his body. His oldest son is on his back, his backbone. His daughter on his chest, near his heart. And his youngest son, Hector, the third, on his bicep for strength. Hector came to the program down on his luck. I'll let him tell the story. Here's Hector. Why'd you get involved?
To be honest, I was getting drunk and high all the time, and I just lost control of, you know, my habits, and so the mother of my boys, she ended up leaving me with her new guy, and she took the kids, and I was just like down and out. My dad, he been in and out of jail. You know, and then my stepdad, and he was always beating on my mom, and, you know, one day I just knocked him down, and then after that, I never went back. Since I was 17, I've been in the street, doing my own thing, you know, so I don't hit women, and I haven't been in jail for a year and a half now. I got out of jail in January 2018, and growing up where I grew up, it was like I couldn't stay out of jail no more than 6 months.
When you think about being a dad, what does it mean to you?
Being able to provide a healthy lifestyle. You know, my kids love me a lot because I take them to the park and we eat a lot of the same things. They like the things that I eat, even the spicy stuff. Yeah. So I see myself in my kids, and I also see myself in my dad.
When you do get that opportunity to get back with your kids and be a functioning dad, how will it be different for you?
Well, first and foremost, I know I won't be drunk or high, you know, or under the influence whatsoever. If anything, I'll be high off life just to have my kids with me. You know, my daughter, she's 9, you know. I see her once every other year, you know, and last time I seen her was around Halloween, around October, you know, that was the last time I seen her. And when I seen her, I she's getting tall, you know, and I just kind of like, I didn't believe she was there.
Are you excited? Are you optimistic that your life is on the right track, that you're going to be reunited with your kids, that you'll see them more often than once a year?
Yeah, I have faith in God for sure, because when my son's mom left me, you know, she took the kids, and I just kind of like raised my hands at God, like, why, God? What? Why? And then, I didn't tell you to get drunk. I didn't tell you to get high, you know. And so I've been going to church. Like I said, I'm in a recovery group, and I believe God will give me my kids when the time is right.
That's Hector's story. On top of just wanting to get his kids back, Hector also uses the program to help him change careers.
I'm not in demolition no more. I'm in construction. So I don't tear things down. I build things up.
Wanted to get that clip in. That's a A great thought from Hector and Ivan, and thank you for sharing your stories. Those are just two of the stories of Chicago dads using the Young Fathers program. Three program managers sat down with me at their 91st Street offices to explain what the goal is and why this program has been successful, and frankly, why we need it at all. Here is Edgar Barba, Nathan Wright, and Doug Brown.
We started this office here, and we had a lot of moms programs, and people in the community began to ask, well, what can we do for the dads? So then we started interviewing guys in the community, have focus groups, and got an idea of what would make a program like this work. So we didn't want it to be just another employment program. What can we really do to have outcomes that will impact their children, their relationships with their partners? How can we get them a checking account in the bank? What about housing? All of these issues. It's amazing. So we started to pull it together from what they said, what they would make it work.
And from that initial idea, you saw there was a need? I mean, fathers stepped forward saying, hey, I want to be a part of this program?
Yes, yeah. Definitely. One of my main carrot, as we call it, to get fathers interested in a program is the job readiness component as well. So that's how we get them into the program during the first week. During the second week, that's when we focus on their fatherhood.
A lot of times, these young men come in, and they think that they have problems, they have issues, and like most men, we figure if I just had a job, if I just had some money, all these things would go away. And it's bigger than that. And that's the thing I think that makes this program so successful is that it is comprehensive. So, yeah, we have the job component. But the first thing you need to do is be ready for the job.
When you're dealing with young men who come in and they're looking for work and then you start to talk to them about being young dads, how do they usually approach it? Are they positive? Are they optimistic about learning more about being a father? Or is it a challenge to get them interested in some of the things that go along with fatherhood?
We used to have a tool that we used to ask them about their fatherhood skills, basically, how good a father they were, that type of thing. We gave it to them at the initial beginning of the program. Everybody is an excellent father. And it's hilarious.
They check off.
Even the ones that the child hasn't been born yet, and they've never had any kids. They're still excellent father. And what happens is after they get into the actual programming and the curriculum and everything, then they start to think about really what it entails. And so when we give it to them again, then you get more realistic answers.
Think back to your childhood. What do you remember from when you were a child? Think about what your parents, do you remember what they got you or what gift they gave you? No, you remember the time they spent with you, the good memories that you have with them. A lot of parents and people in general, they don't realize that that's what they remember when they were a child. We teach them that in order for us to improve and make our society better for our children as well, is to break the cycle that a lot of us tend to repeat and take the good parts that our parents did for us or parental figures and teach that to our children and try to eliminate the bad stuff that we learn and experience.
These guys are already often good fathers, and it's not recognized. That's one of the things that they hear from us from the very beginning that gets them engaged, is that we already know you're doing a good job. It's not recognized, though. And so the whole notion of a deadbeat dad is just not really true, because they're maybe walking them to the school, they're doing different things, so they're very involved, and we build on that. So it's from the point of not a deficit approach, but more like a strength approach that we take with them.
One of the most important parts, I believe, is what is a healthy relationship?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this entails not just between you and the child, but about you and the child's mother, mm-hmm. Your own family relationships, the example set for you, because what we do is we all have a toolbox, okay, and when parenting comes, even if you didn't like the way your father parented, that's all in your toolbox. Okay, so what are you going to take out of there? What you have to work with. So what we have to do first is make them aware of the fact that they're carrying these old habits, even if they didn't like mm-hmm. them, into their relationship with their child. So if they're not aware, then they can't change those. And so once we make them aware, and we actually have roundtable discussions about these things, then they do pick up different things. We talk about what they didn't like or did like or that type of thing. And so they change their habits so that they are aware now. They're doing more, aware parenting.
I love it.
If you will.
Yeah. So I guess the question I have for all three of you guys have been doing this for a while now, but why is there a need for this program? Where does it come from? I mean, what are you seeing when in the community? You're here right here on 91st Street in South Side of Chicago. Why is there a need for a young father program at Metropolitan Family Services?
A lot of these gentlemen have parents who are in and out of jail, and they go into that same lifestyle as well. And one thing I focus on them is about no one wants a worse life that they had for their children. So it's important that you guys guide your children in the correct path and everything as well, because you do not want them to be living the same life as you. And that's what really gets the guys involved with changing their life and showing them that love and support. We work with a lot of guys who are returning citizens, as we say, and we tell them it's important you tell your kids that you love them, and not just tell them, but demonstrate to them, show them, spend time with them. And that's why we have the father-child activities to promote that.
Many times, we're our own worst critic, okay? And men, I say a lot of times, are proud even when we feel like we don't have anything to be proud of. So if we feel like we don't have anything to bring to the table or to contribute, a lot of times we'll just back out of the whole thing. You know, and this is how these kids end up with that deficit in the family of the father. When these fathers get into the program and they start to learn more about the relationships and about employment and just getting themselves on their feet, the first thing they do is run back looking for that woman and that child. Okay, one of the things that we do look at is how many reconciliations we have. Some of these people haven't been involved in the kid's life for years. And now it's like, look at me, I'm doing better, I'm on my feet, I'm working, I'm, you know. We had one father actually go out of state and find his mother and the child's mother and whatnot and bring them back and put their family together. And the whole family dynamic changed. I mean, it's something.
You know, I'll ask about that, about the dynamic, because in some cases, you know, that dynamic, that family dynamic can be toxic, it can be... you know, it can be difficult. Mm-hmm. And do you work with these young dads to recognize their contributions to that toxicity? That, I guess that's the question I have. You know, the idea that it may not be the best course of action. You can get these young dads back on their feet, but it may not be the best course of action to put them back in that scenario.
Yeah, a lot of times there isn't that. There's a lot of deadbeat dads. It's that they got different challenges or struggles holding them from doing that. And like my coworker Nathan mentioned, a lot of times we help them with those barriers. We don't give them a handout, we give them a hand up. We're right there along with them, and we fight with them in order to get their better services. We got our domestic violence team as well, who speaks with the gentlemen and let them know the importance of domestic violence and how it affects the children as well. Because a lot of times these gentlemen might be mistreating their wife or something, or and their daughter seeing that, and we let them know that that's setting an example for the type of guy that your dad, that she's going to be dating. So we put stuff in their head and demonstrate to them how responsible and how, even if you don't believe you're a model for your children, you are, and they do tend to want to be
but
like
I think
you.
Realistically, Justin, you know, it is true that we would love to overcome all the social problems,
yeah,
but we're
right.
limited to, and we recognize
yeah, right.
that sometimes there are disappointments and things that come up, but our goal, of course, is to help them have the tools that they can use to do what they can.
That was Doug Brown, Nathan Wright, and Edgar Barba, program managers for the Young Fathers Program at the Metropolitan Family Services, which is offices at 91st Street. Also, thanks to Hector and Ivan for sharing their stories tonight. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll get the news, and we'll continue our conversation about fathers and fatherhood here on Extension 720 tonight on 720 WGN. Thanks, Don. It is Extension 720 here on 720 WGN Radio. If you came for the flamenco, it's coming up in the next hour. We had some live music in the 7 o'clock. We'll continue that in the 9 o'clock with Jorge and Paco, who are both standing by. And also coming up a little bit later, Kel Mitchell's going to join us from Nickelodeon and the director and star of the new film, The Last Black Man in San Francisco, which is just, it's really good. And if you listen to me on the radio, I'm pretty objective. I'm not the critics. We have great critics here at the station who will tell you one way or the other. But I have to say, I was really kind of blown away by this film. So we'll talk about that coming up a little bit later tonight. Well, we continue our theme on fatherhood. We heard from the perspective of men trying to better themselves, trying to get back on their feet and back in their child's life. But what about the men that are already a functioning member of their family? The roles of men and women in our American families have definitely shifted over the years as more and more women are becoming the breadwinners in the family, and more men are taking on full-time roles when it comes to childcare. But of course, it's not as easy as one might think. as many moms are forced to balance both the workload and the duties at home, data suggests that there are still some discrepancies between the moms and the dads when it comes to the home. For instance, men may be more involved in their children's lives, but they opt for playtime or fun activities like taking the kids to the park, leaving harder childcare chores like homework to the moms. Joining me in studio to talk about the importance of fathers and men when it comes to the new familial structure is Dr. Katie Garner. She's an executive director of the IMAS, which is the International Association of Maternal Action and Scholarship. Dr. Garner grew up in Chicago. She's currently based in Oak Park, and she joins me tonight on Extension 720. Dr. Garner, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
So first off, let's get right into this. It is fair to say that the familial structures have changed because both of us growing up, it was a different kind of way that we grew up.
Absolutely. I grew up in very much the old European model. My dad was a house painter. He oftentimes had two jobs, so he'd go from his first day job and work weekend jobs, and my mom was the full-time stay-at-home mom. And she still says to this day that that was the best job she could have had. So it was, but I didn't know my dad really at all. I still remember being 5 years old and my dad being a painter. He had a little bit extra time in the cold months, and we were going to go down to Florida, and my mom said, oh, well, you guys should drive. I literally didn't know who my dad was. I remember looking up at them and saying, well, my mom thinks this is a good plan, so okay. And I cried all the way to Kentucky. My dad finally bribed me off with some read-along tapes or something along those lines.
And there's that story, which is, of course, resonates with a lot of people who are listening today. And then there's the stereotypical kind of madman relationship.
Right.
The one where the businessman who leaves and goes and works with his, you know, from 9 to 5, and the woman is left to take care of the kids.
Well, and if he was providing the paycheck, that was his primary duty. And a lot of that comes from that sort of post-industrial time period where we did have, because if you go before that, we didn't have that division. You were a family as a unit and everybody sort of chipped in. But it was also that just the roles of women, and women weren't educated. Men took mm-hmm. charge of that. They took charge of the religious education of kids, all of that. So that idea that men were entirely absent from, you know, the point of the 50s all the way before isn't true.
No,
so
it's a modern phenomenon, right?
Isolated time period, but we still hold to that. You know, it was the golden era of America, but clearly our economy doesn't permit that at this point. Mm-hmm. And we're post second wave feminism. Most women don't want to have that set up in their homes anymore.
There has been so much ink, spilled when it comes to the idea of the changing roles of
right.
the American family, and a lot of it is emphasized on the changing role of the mom. She's now the breadwinner, or maybe she's got a full time job and then she's coming home and she's taking care of the family. We can do it all vibe. But rarely, you know, in that story, they'll talk about the dads and how they're changing as well. But rarely do we really dig deep on what that means. What are they doing when it says that they're now taking on more duties and more responsibilities? And when you look at the data, it kind of spills out as well, saying that's not necessarily what's happening.
And I think that's an unfortunate piece of this. And to an extent, I should say that through IMS, we're guilty of it too. I mean, we're their organization for maternal action and scholarship, and we are, I don't think there's a single male member.
Hmm.
Now, how that plays out in terms of the fact that I haven't yet had a man come to me saying he wanted to be a member of the society.
Right, right.
But that idea that the men really aren't even part of the conversation. I think in a lot of ways, when you talk about gay rights and the rights of African Americans, we talk about being allies and that we have an ownership in that, even if you're not part of that particular
right.
group. And yet in the conversation around childcare and some of those conversations about even parenting, I was talking recently with somebody about how we frequently talk about mothering, but even to say the word fathering doesn't roll off the tongue. Like, it's not even part of our vernacular in a real way. And I think that, of course, you know, having kind of an English lit background, that language aspect sticks with me.
Yeah, it's interesting too. And even we heard it in the segment right here in the 7:30 segment was about a lot of the dads they talked about. What does it mean to be a dad? They said to give good advice. to essentially lead or help when and support the son or daughter when they make choices. But he didn't say anything about changing diapers. He didn't say anything about making dinner or cleaning up or even running a household, because that doesn't necessarily, I don't know what it is about our society right now, but even our culture, it doesn't necessarily isn't the first thing off the tongue when it comes to dads talking about fatherhood.
And it is, I would say that I'm kind of a feisty woman in a lot of ways, and okay. You know, and yet I also fell into with. I was a high school teacher before I got into what I'm doing now. I was the one who opted out of my job because I was the one who was earning less. I mean, it was such the typical story with our first kid. My husband was home for a couple days, and then said, "Okay, well, that was that. I'm going back to work now," and I was at home doing the full-time mom thing. And it was, from my side, it was also like, I mean, if I wound up in this situation, you know, what does that say for so many other people that kind of walked into it less informed than I did? Of course, with my second kid, which, you know, a lot of times that second kid, they say it's the same thing for in terms of women being able to retain jobs. But I think a lot of times that's the tipping point in terms of when people will move, women will want to move back by their families, by mm-hmm. their moms, because they need extra help. Or in my case, a lot of it was, you know, dude, you got to step up. Like, this is
well, that's a great
this
place.
Isn't okay anymore.
Let's do that. Let's take a break, because I want to. That might be a great place to pick up, because the idea of stepping up and what that means. Because as I mentioned in the lead, this idea of, you know, men are stepping up, fathers are stepping up and taking on duties they never took on before, but they are almost selective in what they're choosing, just based on the data and the idea of they get to pick and choose and everything else gets sort of relegated to their partner. We'll talk about that. Dr. Katie Garner is my guest tonight. She's the executive director of IMAS, which is the Internal Association of Maternal Action and Scholarship. We're talking about fatherhood tonight here on Extension 720. Stay with us. Talking fatherhood tonight, Extension 720, 720 WGN. I am Justin Kaufman. Dr. Katie Garner is my guest. She's the executive director of IMAS, which is the International Association of Maternal Action and Scholarship. We're talking about fatherhood. And I want to paint the picture. I want to say that this, you know, we're talking about some of the texters that text in are like, oh, wait, says who? I do all this stuff. I mean, there has been an increase in the childcare duties and the home responsibilities over time. It's not, we're not stating that in 1957 is the same as 2019. There has been significant increases in men doing things at home.
Absolutely. So a recent Pew research showed that it was 2.5 hours that men were spending with their kids on an average, obviously.
What are we talking? What year?
So, but now we're up to 8.
So 2.5 in the 60s?
In 1965. Yeah, okay. So, and now in 2018, we're at 8 hours.
Okay.
So you're talking almost a four-time increase.
Yeah.
And
that's great.
That's huge. And so I think a lot of men, of course, they look at that and they even sense it, you know, whether or not they're looking
at
the data. Say, give me the medal. I mean, I'm doing a great job.
They give out medals? I want a Father's Day medal. Yeah.
They sell them at Esco. They're usually plastic.
But then to look and see, and when you look at the numbers, the hours that are being spent by mothers, I mean, it's much larger.
Well, right. And that's actually something that, you know, some of the pushback from conservative sides will say, like, oh, well, women aren't spending as much time with their kids because they're working. Honestly, that's not what the research is showing at all. Women are working, and they're still spending more time with their kids, because it used to be, of course, you know, go out and play down the block and come back, you know, when the dinner bell rings. But so women are spending on average 14 hours versus the 8 for men.
So what I also find interesting is there's data as well. You know, you see this, and I think I'm guilty of this as well, but this idea that even when it's a paternity leave, when a man's going to leave because of a birth of their son or daughter, they're chomping at the bit to get back. There's this idea, and that shows in the data that's one area where men could probably improve upon this idea that they want to get back in the flow as fast as they can. They're not necessarily trying to take that leave.
Well, certainly I would say that that's not uncommon. On the other hand, I think there's times, or some of the research is showing anyway, that men do want to stay at home longer, but the culture of their work is such that if you do take your full paternity leave, you're somehow a wuss, or you don't take your job seriously, or you're not invested, or any of those sorts of things.
And that's so back to that really cultural thing,
is,
right?
Right. So, you know, and I think that was why, you know, you can say, oh, it doesn't really matter that Zuckerberg took his family leave. But in a way, having, you know, the top of the company say, look, I'm doing it, it's fine for you to do it too. Because that paternity leave thing really is, they're showing more and more that when men take that leave, it sets the course for truly the trajectory of the entire relationship there forward. Because, and, you know, like I said before, you know, I lived it too, that, you know, I was the one nursing my kid. I was the one who was hands-on doing all of that stuff. I became the expert with that kid. So even as my child grew older, and I was in a totally different, like, oh, I don't know what I'm doing now. My husband still looked to me and said, well, you know, you're the expert in the house. Here, deal with it, because of those early weeks.
Well, it's this concept, and I think this falls into the category of this maternal gatekeeping, where there is this concept, and I think I struggle with this in my relationship, is that my wife, she sets the rules. She sets the way this is going to go, and my sort of out-of-the-box idea as a dad or a parent to, you know, I want to parent this way, isn't necessarily met with optimism or encouragement, if you will.
No, and sometimes actually I would say it's quite the opposite. I mean, and I always, there is the term maternal gatekeeping, and that is that sort of phenomenon that you're talking about, where women do take a lot of ownership over that job. And so even when they're totally stressed out and struggling, there's, because we're, you know, as women and as mothers, feeling that cultural pressure to not, you know, let the plates fall or anything. So to hand it off says something that you're somehow inferior as a mom. But it's also that, you know, you can look at, again, you know, all the data and stuff, that men oftentimes will parent differently. They're more physical. They're more focused on gross motor skills. They're focused on safety, but in a different way than mothers are focused on safety. A lot of times men, you know, kind of that outside threat thing versus, but sure, go ahead and jump off the wall. You know, I don't care.
Right.
You know, and
right.
So all of that where, you know, and I do think that sometimes there's just there's room for compromise on both sides. That I think that there's certainly some movement that women can make in terms of being more accepting to different ways of parenting. But I think men sometimes, you know, I laugh at the YouTube video of the guy with the vacuum cleaner who's trying to do his daughter's ponytail. You know, and it's like, come on. I mean, does it really have to be done with a vacuum cleaner? Are you just trying to make this
or just creative
thing
and,
just for the sake
yeah,
of
right.
it?
Yeah, right. YouTube video. Well, my last thought is just about, you know, as we think about what we can do as men, as we think about the privilege that we've had, I mentioned this at the beginning, this idea that we can pick and choose, that I may feel like I'm contributing to the chores and to the childcare, but I, at the end of the day, I'm picking and choosing what I want to do. And some of the harder stuff, I'm like, well, someone else will do it, meaning my wife, which is not fair. And I feel like over time, what can I do to rectify that? What can I do? What are the actionable items for men who may be listening to this saying, all right, you got me. What can I do?
I think a lot of it is, you know, having a sit down with those candid conversations of what do you feel like you're doing here? What am I doing here? And really just, you know, being honest with one another. You know, I think it must exist. I haven't found it yet, but just a really comprehensive list of all the things that go into running a house when you have kids, pets, two jobs, all of those things. And then you can put check marks down the whole thing. Because I think, you know, it's so often, but some of that stuff's just not measurable. And I think that's where you're seeing a little bit more pushback from women on the whole, like, but I'm hearing the emotional load of all of this stuff. But a lot of it comes from work, too, that we need to restructure where we don't have either person working 80 hours a week so that you can both be present for your family and have that.
Dr. Katie Gardner is the executive director of IMAS, which is the International Association of Maternal Action and Scholarship, talking about fatherhood and some of the research that lends itself to how fatherhood and the structure, the familial structure in America is changing here in 2019. Dr. Gardner, we hope to have you back, and thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much for having me.
Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, the new film, The Last Black Man in San Francisco, is in theaters this weekend. The movie tells the story of a young man in San Francisco who finds his family's old house empty and, well, moves in.
Maybe he's right. What if we shouldn't be here? Well, we should be here more. Some millionaire.
Last Black Man in San Francisco is not a hostile, gritty real estate saga about squatters' rights or property rights, although it could be. This is a well-told story about love, loss, and family. It's a story that deals with gentrification, identity, and most of all, friendship. It's a semi-autobiographical story written and directed by childhood friends Jimmy Fails and Joe Talbot. Jimmy stars as Jimmy in the film, and Joe directs it. It's getting great reviews, and I must say the film is the best I've seen so far this year. An angry love letter to the city they call home. Jimmy Fails, Joe Talbot in studio tonight. Thanks for being here, guys.
Thank you, man.
Thank you for having me.
I really enjoyed the film. And I guess I'll start with you, Jimmy. Just the idea of putting your story to film. Where does it come from?
It just comes from, you know, walks and talks me and Joe had back in the day as teenagers, talking about life and whatever comes up, you know, the city, life, girls, whatever. Kind of just was a very informal idea that just came up just from literally a talk we were having. And then it, you know, we did a little concept trailer, and the concept trailer was, you know, me riding through the city on the skateboard, kind of similar to in the film, and in the beginning of the film, and Joe was filming it, you know, and that was right here. He was driving the car. His little brother. And we did that, and that was sort of a calling card that brought the people that made up our core team, sort of, and that helped us make it happen, you know?
Yeah, basically, it was a family affair for a long time, family and friends. We had made movies together in high school, but we'd never done anything quite like this, a feature on this larger scale. Right. So, as Jimmy said, we shot this concept trailer, and we cobbled together this group of what felt like the last artists in the Bay Area working together for years on this. As, you know, for many of us, it was our first venture into feature filmmaking. So here we are now. I can't really believe it.
And it's great because you feel that this film is not just telling Jimmy's story and telling a great story about the house on Golden Gate and everything about that, which we'll get to. But you feel that it's about San Francisco, and you can feel that this was a process, that this is an indie film at its best, because it takes place in San Francisco from people who live in San Francisco. I said angry love letter, but it is a love letter.
Yeah. I mean, we worked through a lot of our feelings about the city with each draft. I think the first draft was angrier, and with each consecutive draft, I think it became more loving and empathetic, which feels like the spirit of the city. It's not to be hateful in our fight back against what's happening, but to try to lead with love. And I think a lot of that comes from Jimmy as a person and as the character in this film.
Jimmy, as someone who, I mean, this is semi-autobiographical, so a lot of the scenes in the film actually happened to you.
Yeah.
As the actor, having to recreate scenes from your own life, what's that like? I mean, is that hard to do? Is it challenging?
I mean, it's hard and it's not. It's like, it's easy because it happened to you, so you can remember this sort of feeling. You know, you remember it very vividly, so it's not hard to recreate it in that sense, but it is hard to recreate it because you do have to go back to that feeling that you had when you were there. So that's what makes it hard. But
so you're mentally going to that place that you actually experienced.
Absolutely.
And there's some tough scenes in this film. There's some films that it's not just skateboarding around the city. There's some tough scenes about family. There's tough scenes about friends and people that you lose. So that's not an easy thing to mentally go back to some of those places.
Yeah, no, not at all. But end of the day, you know, you walk out a better man, and you get over some of those resentments you had with some of your family, and you get over, you know, you deal with a lot of those demons you had. So I think I came out of this a better person.
Joe, the film, you know, like we just said, it's a love letter to San Francisco, but it takes on a lot of issues that many people here in Chicago would recognize, and that could be gentrification, inequality, this concept of what once was yours is not yours anymore.
Right.
And really kind of grabbing your head around that. I can't tell you, my family's from Chicago, and I'll go back and see where my dad grew up.
Mm-hmm.
It ain't that anymore.
Right.
Someone else is living in that house, and that house ain't even a house anymore. It's a condo, or it's whatever. But you have these feelings of trying to attach yourself to where you're from, even though it's no longer like that.
Yeah, it's been interesting touring with the film and really starting to get a sense of just how large this issue is of gentrification, the changing faces of American cities throughout the country, and frankly, even internationally at this point. You know, we got letters early on from people as far as London and Paris saying these same things are happening here. But, you know, I think it feels like this destruction of regional identity and regional culture, you know, thinking back to a time when you had accents and buildings certain very minute details of a conversation you might have with a neighbor that feel very specific to that region, certain food. And everywhere we go on this tour, you know, there's avocado toast and acai bowls, right? Which I thought was a Bay Area sort of thing, but it's everywhere now, everywhere. You know, and the same yoga pants. And I mean, it just feels like our cities are, yes. And I think that is an unfortunately universal feeling. And so it's odd, you know, in some ways it's really warming to go to these different cities and see how resonant our film, that's very much a love letter to San Francisco, down to the casting and the exact Muni bus that we use that feels like the one we grew up with versus the new one. And yet in an eerie sense, people are finding ways to connect with it, because I think, like you said, it is happening.
It definitely relates, and to living in Chicago. What I also find interesting too is you know, this is really a story about, it is about family. And Jimmy, tonight, the Extension 720, we're kind of going after, you know, Father's Day theme, talking about fatherhood. And this film, there's a great relationship, even though there's not much of a relationship between you and your dad in the film. And that plays out, and that's a big part of the film. What's your thoughts on fatherhood and how it plays out in this film?
I mean, I was raised by my dad, so we're very tight. So I don't necessarily think that the film is reflecting what our relationship is now at all. It's more of the resentments I had towards when I was younger and what he was trying to do, how he went about showing his love and for me being so naive and wanting that house back, you know. So we just had to show that part, and it was hard for, you know, my dad watched it, and it was hard for him to even see himself being that harsh, but that's how it was. But you know, he's also, we have a different relationship now. So
there's a great part in the film, and I don't know if this is autobiographical or not, is it's just the way that your character changes his clothes when he comes around his dad. Doesn't want his dad.
That's pretty autobiographical. I mean, the thing is, I did do that for a while, but me and my dad are so tight that it got to a point where it was like, I can just, you know, the first couple of times I was like, oh, you know, change clothes, whatever, just so he doesn't say anything. But then it's like,
well, what were you afraid he was going to say?
Exactly what he said in the movie. Why are you dressed like a white boy? That's what he said. That's literally that's autobiographical. That's what he said when I first pulled up on the skateboard with, you know, my flannel and whatever I was wearing.
We're talking about the film, The Last Black Man in San Francisco, which is in theaters this weekend. In studio, the director, Joe Talbot, and the star, Jimmy Fails. All right, we'll take a quick break, come back, and we'll continue the conversation about this film here on Extension 720. Stay with us. Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I am Justin Kaufman. The film The Last Black Man in San Francisco is in theaters now, one of the best of 2019. I'm not just saying that. That's getting great reviews everywhere you guys go. Congratulations, Joe Talbot and Jimmy Fails in studio. The story of this film, which is so great, is really surrounding a house. And for people who don't live in San Francisco, these are the, I don't know if they're right to call it the Painted Ladies, but but the idea that these Victorian architecture, this amazing house that is built by the grandfather of Jimmy in the film, and the idea that it no longer belongs to the family. It's been gentrified and it's someone else's house. But Jimmy won't let it go. Is that an autobiographical part of this film?
I think it was for a very long time. You know, I'm an older man now. I mean, that it comes more from this is a 5-year process. So the initial story was how I felt at that time. I used to go back to the house all the time. The house represents family for me. It represents ownership and my grandfather, who was my idol. I think, you know, that's the main sentiment. And I mean, in the character, it's like a very younger character in and of myself, you know, I mean, mm-hmm. it's based on myself, but I think it is a younger character in being so naive in that way. But I feel like that was important, you know. And also, I mean, I think of it when I'm watching it, I feel like me and mine are like two little kids. It kind of seems like we're like two younger boys just kind of figuring it out. That's kind of what it seems like.
That's a great way to put it, though. There is a childhood aspect to it. But at the same time, this house on Golden Gate, it's a main character. And when you think about directing a film like this that's going to have it all about the house, the living space, Are you thinking about how you're going to show it, how it plays, and even in scenes where they're in front of it or around it, and it's necessarily about the house?
Yeah, you know, watched a lot of HGTV. No, you know, it is. It sounds like a cliche, but the house really does feel. I think it was important that it feel like a character to understand why Jimmy is fighting so hard for this place. I think, obviously, most importantly, it's what it means to him, even if it's weren't as grand of a property. But I think in this story, we would talk about sometimes how it's a love story between a man and a house. And it's also, you know, about this deposed prince who's banished to the outskirts of San Francisco, makes these pilgrimages back to the heart of the city to one day try and reclaim the family throne. So when you think about it in that way, we really wanted to find a house that captured the magic of Jimmy's imagination, a place that, you know, he remembers from his childhood, but he hasn't gone back in since. And so we spent over a year trying to find the right place in San Francisco. And that's one of the places where our team and this collaborative effort really showed. It was me taking walks. It was one of our co-producers, Luis Alfonso, Jonna Tichette, our production designer, Jimmy, Kalia, like our whole unit, this collective of people before the movie was financed, long before we had any sort of certainty that it would even be made, let alone shown in theaters, people hitting the ground in San Francisco, knocking on doors. And what we would find is whenever we'd see a beautiful facade, we'd go inside and we'd be bracing ourselves because so often the inside would be gutted and all that great detailing that makes Victorian so special and so unique would be lost. And so we finally knocked on the door of a house that I used to pass on my way to school with my mom and my brother Nat. And this was a house that was like a dream house to us. And an old man beckoned us inside, also named Jim. And it turned out that awesome. It was amazing. It was like he became our fairy godfather because we went inside and the whole modern world faded away. And it was even more remarkable when we learned that he had actually done a lot of the work on the house himself. He'd spent the last 50 years of his life doing everything from building organs into the walls, which you see in the film, to actually carving the witch hat shingle by shingle. Yeah. Which is also featured in the film. So in some ways, he became an inspiration for the character, too, as someone that really had devoted himself to this property.
Took care of the house, yeah. And you could, and you get that feeling. That's what I mean by the authentic. You could tell that this is made by people who love the city because you get the feeling you picked the right house. It's not the Full House or whatever it might be. But you know what I mean? Right. Like that there was some care put into this. Jimmy, one of the other things about this story, and this happens in Chicago as well, we just had a study that came out that talked about how much money was essentially stolen from African American homeowners in the 80s and 90s in Chicago. 70s, 80s, and 90s. There's a study about just generational wealth and how certain real estate practices got African American families on the south side of Chicago to contract instead of buy. Mm-hmm. Regardless, that's a news story, right? Yeah, that's a terrible thing. But it resonates in this film because you recognize that there should be generational wealth. There should be the house should be Jimmy's. Mm-hmm. It should be because of practices, whatever, gentrification, however it was, because of the beauty of the
architecture. That's how it feels for everyone else, you know.
But that seems to be a part of this film as well. It's a comedy. It's eccentric. It's a great. Well, I don't want to paint a picture of this film as, you know, dark.
No, of course.
Picking on the issues of our world. But this is a big issue about black families that get their property taken from them.
Hell yeah, man. And I don't even want to say it, you know, necessarily was taken. It does feel that way. But we did, you know, it was like a loss. You know, there was a lot of family issues and everything that led to that as well as it being taken. It was a little of both. You know, I don't want to just say that we're completely innocent of doing anything that would have, or my family is of, you know, of losing
didn't
the house.
Pay it.
Sure.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
You know, it's like, so, but, yeah, I mean, that's definitely an issue. It's like, I can't even name, I can count on my fingers how many of my friends that are black that are going to inherit their parents' house. I have like one friend I can think of off the top of my head named Mike, and he's from the Fillmore, and he still lives in his parents' house, and he's probably going to have that. Everyone always goes over there. It's like the neighborhood. It's kind of like how my house was when I was there, when I was younger. It's like it's the neighborhood house. Everyone goes there, hang out. Everyone's always in and out there, and that's like the only person off the top of my head that I know.
That's the thing in San Francisco. It's like so hard to overstate the importance of home. Not only is it a place that you gather, that you feel comfort and safety in, your family, your friends sometimes live there. That's what our home was. Mm-hmm. We lived in my parents' house for 5 years to make this film, Jimmy and I both. You know, if we did not have that home, there's no way we could have afforded to stay in San Francisco as broke artists. Even, you know, the joke in our family was when Brad Pitt came on to be our executive producer, I'd be taking out the trash and my neighbors would go, how's your little film going? And my mom would shout, well, Brad Pitt's making his film. And they'd look at us like, yeah, sure, you're crazy. Uh-huh, that's nice, very nice. But it was, that's the truth. You can live in your parents' basement and have a movie being executive produced by one of the biggest stars in Hollywood. And so home really means so much in San Francisco, I think, right now. And like you said, inheriting your homes. You know, there was a great article actually that came out by, I believe, a Chicago writer about seeing each of the characters in the film through home ownership.
Yeah.
You know, the guys who are on the corner who don't have homes, who live in the projects up the street. Jimmy's character longing for this home, building some of his life around the identity, you know, of wanting this home. The only character who has one is Montgomery. His best friend, who has, through that in part and through the relationship with his grandfather, he's grounded in a different way, you know?
That's a great way to look at it. I mean, really think about the different backgrounds of these characters. You said something, I think it was in Rolling Stone, I was reading about San Francisco, and I think Chicago's a little bit like this, but San Francisco obviously is unique, that people would go to San Francisco at one point to go to San Francisco, meaning they want to be a part of that culture.
Exactly.
They want to be a part of, maybe it was eccentric, maybe it was weird, maybe it was a place that you would fit in. I want to fit in there. You think about the 60s and the 70s.
Yep.
And now it's not unlike the 19th century gold rush.
Well, I mean, you want to fit in, but for different reasons. You want to fit in to the new startup or something.
Or
like
for
that.
Money or things
or
like
for
that.
Or for money or for something like that.
What does that do for you guys as San Francisco born
and bred? Well, it pushes us out. It makes the artist community a lot. The artist community is dwindling a lot. It feels, you know, like you said earlier, it feels like we had the last group of artists all working on this film. You know, like the fact that it's like 70 people in a city that's like has a million people coming in and out every day. It's like, that's it. You know, the artists are the curators of the culture. So it's like you can't push us out, you know.
And yet they are. But you're absolutely right. I mean, you pulled the words out of our mouths. This is something we've been saying, is people have come to San Francisco to be fully themselves in a way that they couldn't in the small towns or the cities that they came from. You know, you can't go any further west than San Francisco. So whether it's Bohemians going back to the 1860s, Mark Twain, or African Americans coming from the South to work in the shipyards during World War II, or the Beats in the 50s, or Janis Joplin and Grace Slick in the 60s, gays, you know, this is a city that welcomed everyone with open arms. And it's ironic that that same city is pushing those people out, the real people that make San Francisco what it is, in droves. So for us as artists growing up there, we grew up on a lot of the music and films, Coppola and those great 60s bands are all people who arrived in San Francisco. So now I think we feel an onus, because you're not attracting the next great poet or songwriter, because you'd have to be crazy if you are to come to San Francisco now with how expensive it is. The onus to make the art about San Francisco is on those of us that grew up there.
Childhood friends, 11 and 15, something like that, like where you guys first met each other. Mm-hmm. What is it like? You're here on a tour now, this film's coming out, to have made a film together, to make this project, to think back to those days to now. What is that process like?
You know, it's like crazy to make a movie that people actually see now. You know, we've been making them. And so it's just, I mean, it's just, it's all surreal, but it's all, you know, it's like it shows you do have to start from somewhere, you know.
One of the movies we made back in high school, my brother and I made it, my brother Nat, and it's a movie where I'm in it as well. Me and Jimmy go out to the suburbs for what becomes a very strange weekend with two girls that we meet in the city, and sort of about city kids being very out of place in the suburbs and running back to the city as quickly as we can. But we made that movie with a friend of ours named Sam Jackson, not the Samuel Jackson, but she's a local actress in the Bay. And she hadn't seen us since we made that movie.
Wow.
So she came to the premiere and she was just like, what is going on? I mean, it's just surreal. Like at the premiere, we looked at one point out in the audience and Danny Glover, who every San Franciscan grows up knowing Danny because he's from the city. And he's just like a wonderful, you know, living embodiment of San Francisco. I look over, we see Danny Glover talking to Barry Bonds. at the premiere. We're just like, oh my God, what do you do with that?
Yeah, just.
What do you do with that?
Right? Yeah, man.
It's wild.
The film is called The Last Black Man in San Francisco. It's in theaters this weekend. The director, Joe Talbot, and Jimmy Fails, who's a semi-autobiographical story, and the actor, the main character. You guys, great film. Thanks for being my guest tonight.
Hey, thank you for having us, man.
Thank you for having us.
Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest is bringing back one of the classic sketch comedy shows of the 90s. We're talking about Nickelodeon's All That.
Hey, are you Patty? No, I ain't no Patty. My name is Lester Oaks, construction worker. Hiya, Lester. Son, I'm a hungry, hungry, hungry. Well, then you should go to a restaurant, restaurant, restaurant. Look, son, just fry me up one of those newfangled good burgers. The one with four pieces of meat, and hurry it up. I got things to construction.
Okay.
One good burger with 40 pieces of meat. Hey, hey. Hold the hard hat there, Smiley. Did I just heard you were ordering me a 40 pieces of meat and burger?
Hey, look at here, Patty. I think I know what I'm doing here.
Bet you don't. First off, my name is Lester Oaks, construction worker. I ain't no Patty woman. You're number 37, Patty.
Kel Mitchell was a big part of All That. He, alongside Kenan Thompson, started a career on the show, and that led to Kenan and Kel and the big careers for both of them, including the film Good Burger, which was based on an All That sketch. Kel has been a mainstay on Nickelodeon. He presently stars on the sitcom Game Shakers. Kel Mitchell is originally from Chicago, and he's in studio with me right now on Extension 720. Kel, thanks for being here. Nice to meet you.
Man, thank you for having me. I'm excited.
So this, you're from Chicago. What's it like to get back to town?
Always awesome, man. Always awesome to see the family, and always let them know, hey, I'm coming to town. You know, so
when you were here in Chicago growing up here, was the goal always to be an entertainer, to be someone in Hollywood?
No, it wasn't. You know what? It started out as a hobby. You know, my parents wanted me. That's why I love the arts in school, and you know, and just the arts in general. I always support it because my parents wanted me to do something positive, and I was getting to that age where I was like, okay, let's get him into something positive because he's a bit of a class clown. So, and they tried a lot of different things, but acting was the one that stuck. And I started out at ETA Creative Arts Foundation.
Fantastic,
yeah,
place,
man,
yeah.
Fantastic place. Renaku Jahi, amazing drama teacher, and it changed everything for me. I fell in love with the art of acting, man, and I just started acting there, doing a bunch of great plays. And then I started doing stuff at Victory Gardens, got an agent, Aria Talent Agency out here. And yeah, my mom was managing me at the time. And things took off, man.
I was gonna say, when you say they took off, for you to go from being a young kid, a teenager who's doing stuff with ETA and here in Chicago to Nickelodeon, what's that like? What's that transition in your life?
it was funny. I mean, at first I did get like a modeling gig for Captain Crunch, and that was like on the back of the Crunch Berries box. So I thought that was it right there, because I remember the kids were like chasing me around in my neighborhood and everything, like, he's on the back of the Crunch Berry box. But then All That came along. And when All That came along, around that time, it used to be just like commercials and like you do print work, but it wasn't any like TV shows for like kids like that big that would come. And when that audition came out here, it was amazing. I remember I was going to CVS High School, and I was in my sophomore year, and I remember I had finals that day. But then I had this big audition, and I just remember driving up there. I was the last one to audition. You know, they were like putting the boxes up and everything, man, but I got through, man. So it changed everything. It was really pretty cool.
That show, All That, you know, it continues. Obviously, we're talking about the reboot, but it continues to live in everybody's memories, because you talk to anybody, even here at the station, other places, they're like, oh, All That's coming back. There is this, I don't know, nostalgia to it, of course, and obviously it's going to be a new show, but do you be a part of nostalgia and people, a certain generation's childhood?
Yeah.
Well, how does that feel for you?
It's awesome, man. I mean, I get parents coming up to me going, oh man, I watched you when I was a kid, and now my kid watches you, you know, on your current shows. And it's weird. Like, I know, like, when we did All That in the beginning, we did not know that it would be this successful, like, because we did it as a special and we were just seeing if it would work. And then, you know, season after season, it just kept doing better and better. And it's really surreal. Like, even now we're going, wow. So now we're bringing it back after all these years, and the fans have never left. You know, it holds a special place in a lot of people's hearts. When I'm at a red light, people are doing the Good Burger thing. They're like, dude, welcome to Good Burger for me. You know, I get orange soda. I get free burgers everywhere I go. So it's just awesome, man.
It's really, really interesting because I have an 11-year-old son, and he has discovered all that. Mm-hmm. And he discovered Good Burger. And it's not his generation. And it's something because of the way the internet works now that you can pretty much get at anything.
Mm-hmm.
You find yourself being influential to several generations. It's not just to kids who watched it when it was on Nickelodeon. The YouTube and other places have made you relevant to several generations.
Yeah, it's crazy. I have 8-year-olds coming up to me going, welcome to Good Burger. And it's like, you weren't born when that was out. And you're right. It's YouTube. It's the internet. They find it out, or their parents are introducing them to it. Because my show Game Shakers, a lot of kids would go, oh, that's Double G. But then the parent would go, no, that's Kel Kimble from Kenan and Kel. And
that might have been me. That might have been it.
Right, man. And they'll introduce them, and it's crazy, man, where you got the whole family. And that's why we're excited about all that coming back, because the whole family is going to be watching this, you know, and that's what we're excited about. We're bringing that family television time back together, where it's not everybody's just watching different things in other rooms on their iPads or things like that. Everybody's coming to watch it together.
You have a major name in, obviously, in entertainment, but also family entertainment. To be someone who, Game Shakers, you mentioned on Nickelodeon, but you've had such a relationship with this network where with all that, Good Burger, now with Game Shakers and the reboot of all that, a lot of your career has been with this network and has been in family entertainment.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
Oh,
do you think that was going to be the course of your career?
It's funny. I mean, I'm just letting God do what he does, man. You know what I mean? I keep coming back to family entertainment, which is awesome. You know what I mean? I even have a show on CBS called Tales of Valor, where it's about service dogs, you know, and that's family entertainment too. So it's like, it's all together, man. I just love family, and I could go to bed at night, you know, knowing that I didn't do anything crazy or film anything nuts that I feel bad about. You know what I mean? So it is good going to sleep, you know, with a smiley face, knowing that, okay, yeah, that was a good thing we did put out there.
You know? The all that reboot, of course, is Kenan Thompson is executive producer.
Yeah.
You're producing as well as guest starring on the show. It's going to be a teenage cast, you know, like it was back in the 90s.
Yeah.
You and Kenan have you're almost inseparable in the way that people see you together because of Good Burger, because of all that.
Yeah.
As you become adults, and you both go in your own separate direction, how does that relationship, how do you foster that relationship and stay together creatively?
Yeah, man. So social media is definitely a big thing, and texting all the time, because he lives in New York and I'm in LA. And us producing together, I mean, we went from cast members at a very young age, you're talking about 15 years old, to almost then turning into like brothers. You know what I mean? And then now executive producing with, you know, someone you consider a family member. Like right when I was coming up here, he had just texted me and he was like, get it, bro. Like, cause he saw like my post from Chicago that we're doing promo for Slime Fest and for all that. So, yeah, man, we're just, you know, it's been awesome. We're fathers now. So we talk about a lot about that now.
Yeah.
We talk about our kids and stuff like that. Cause people would probably imagine like, oh, they're going on crazy adventures. Well, I mean, usually we just get together, you know, get some food at the house for our wives and the kids and just chilling. You know what I mean?
That's a great evolution for you to talk about fatherhood. I mean, to be someone who started your career at such a young age and was in part of family entertainment, to continue to have the reboot, to play dads on TV shows, and to be a dad yourself.
Yeah.
As we approach Father's Day here, what is that? It's such an interesting journey for you to think about it that way. I mean, you have been a part of a lot of different families in the fact that you're on the television. But for fatherhood, what's it mean to you?
It means a lot. I have a 20-year-old that's in college, and then I have a 17-year-old. She just graduated from high school. And then I have a little 1-year-old that's about to be 2, July 22nd. And it's awesome, man. I mean, to see my son become a man, you know, and then to see my little girls, you know, look at me like, you know, hey, he's Superman, that's dad, you know what I mean? So it's awesome. It's just an awesome feeling. And it's a blessing. It really is a blessing. You know, the kids are a blessing. That's what they tell us. And I know that to be true, because my life has been blessed even more. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I'm ready to have some more. You know, everybody's like, yo, Kel, you got some more kids? I'm like, yeah, they're a blessing, man. I'm trying to get blessed, brother.
Well, it's just the role that you've played
in so many people's lives. It is really, like you said, it's based on family entertainment. Mm-hmm. You have been a big part of what Nickelodeon has presented to audiences for years now.
Yeah.
It is an interesting evolution to think about where you started and where you're at. And, yeah. and as you see in your career is just really in the, you're in the middle of it.
Uh-huh.
It has been such a distinguished one to start at such a young age.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think about the evolution of your career from being the 15-year-old kid who was on All That to now being the executive producer, guest star on All That? Do you think about how you've matured and evolved, not only as an entertainer, but as a person?
Yeah, recently. I have. Like, Keenan and I were both talking about that, especially with the return of All That. And then with me and my wife, you know, there's things that, you know, accomplishments and goals that we've prayed for and things that we wanted to see happen. And now it's happening. And then you kind of just look at the evolution of it. Like, oh, this connected because this connected. This connected because I did this and I met this person and this, you know, and over a span of time. And a lot of people, when they see it, you know, it's like, okay, he's just doing this out of nowhere. But it's like, it was a long period of time, you know what I mean, of things that happen for a reason. And I'm thankful to still be doing it, you know, as far as, you know, actors and in entertainment. It's awesome to still be doing it and to still have this relevance and, you know, have this nostalgia that's with people's hearts, you know. Definitely thankful, you know. Yeah.
Kel is here. Kel Mitchell, the longtime star of Nickelodeon shows like All That, of course, the film Good Burger, which we just watched the other week.
It's, I did.
Yeah, it's so great to see you here. And, of course, the reboot of All That, which is coming to Nickelodeon on the 15th. Kel, can't thank you enough for coming in, talking thank to you. Us about your career and about the show, and good luck with the reboot. All right, the moment you've been waiting for, more flamenco. Flamenco Passion this weekend, Stokey at the North Shore Center. Performing Arts. Talk with the executive director of Ensemble Español and Paco Fanta, playing guitar, coming up here right after the news. I got a great text from 815 that said earlier when we were talking about fishing, the great point to say, I heard you said, I love how you said I did fishing in Wonder Lake. That's not how you say it. Earlier in the show, I was saying I'm going fishing this weekend, and I was kind of joking about the fact that I'm looking forward to it and not looking forward at the same time. I want to catch a fish, but I don't have a long-standing tradition with fishing. I have a favorite story when I was growing up in Wonder Lake. It started to rain, and my dad and I were on a pier, and my dad was casting, and the rain was coming down. One more, Swing Beach, down to Swing Beach. It was Swing, Slide, Center. Those were the names of the beaches. Anyway, Swing Beach, and one more, and it was raining. Come on, Dad. And he caught a huge carp. Right. Well, he got it right when it was raining. It was like, ugh, gross. That's what I mean. Like, I would have been okay if you didn't catch it. And there's a great story also. We were up in Boulder Junction, up in northern Wisconsin. We were out there for lakes, and Dad took us on this boat, and this little boat, and my mom was there. And we were casting and just kind of doing off the boat and kept getting stuck in the weeds, right? That's how that's like 90% of fishing. What is that? Is that a fit? No, it's a tire. Or it's a weed, or it's a, you know, some sort of seaweed or whatever. Seaweed, again, fishing knowledge. So anyway, my mom was holding it, and she's like, and my dad's like, I think you got something there, Jackie. I think you got something. And she's like, it's just the weeds, Lenny. And this northern pike, those things are nasty, man. They got like teeth and the whole bit. It came out like an old Milwaukee commercial, like, oh, Milwaukee, like flipping out of the water, like, wow. And it came down, and my mom just threw the fishing rod into the water. My dad reached over, and he grabbed it, and he fought the fish, and he got the fish. And that, I don't even know. Then, what for? I mean, if you're a real fisherman, you take them back, you know, skin the fish and do the little things like that. Not in this case. It's the northern pike. What are you going to do with it? I don't know. So I'm looking forward to fishing. And as I said, taking my son with my dad for Father's Day. We're going out there. My brother will be there too. And I said, we'll fish until the whining starts. And I'm not talking about my son. I'm talking about me. It is Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. Very excited. We've been waiting all night for this. We heard it early on in the show, some flamenco. But we're going to have a conversation with Ensemble Español about their big show, their Flamenco Passion Show at North Shore Center for the Performing Arts coming up this weekend in Skokie. But first, more flamenco.
Hola, Jorge Perez from Ensemble Español, Spanish Dance Theater.
I'm Paco Fonta, flamenco guitarist and singer from Ensemble Español.
Yes, how about that? Paco Fanta, flamenco guitarist in studio. He and Jorge Perez will join us right after the break. Here, we'll take a break, and then we'll come back and have a conversation about what they're doing this weekend with Flamenco Passion and honoring the legacy of their founder. That's coming up here on Extension 720. Stay with us. Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I am Justin Kaufman. Well, this weekend, Ensemble Español Spanish Dance Theater takes over the North Shore Theater for the annual Flamenco Passion Performances. These three performances are part of the overall Spanish Dance and Music Festival. This is the 43rd annual festival. The Flamenco Passion Performances are always a delight, and they will feature more than 40 dancers and musicians in the fusion of flamenco styles. Of course, flamenco is the folkloric musical tradition of Spain, both song and dance. But this year, the performances will be bittersweet, as it'll be a tribute to Ensemble Español founder Dame Libby Camacho. She died earlier this year. Joining me in studio to talk about the legacy of Dame Libby and to talk and perform flamenco are Jorge Perez, the executive director of Ensemble Español, and flamenco guitarist Paco Fanta. Great to see you guys again. Thanks for coming in and performing. It's a treat to always have you guys right here before the Flamenco Passion. Thanks for being here.
You bet. Thank you.
Justice, for having us.
I want to get into all of what's happening with the festival this year, but just a real quick primer on flamenco. This is something that obviously Flamenco Passion is the part of this festival that is always the part that shines. But give us a little bit of an idea of what flamenco is.
Well, the flamenco style that the ensemble embraces, of course, is the presentation, preservation, and promotion of the southern part of Spain in Andalusia. And the ensemble's repertoire in these last 43 years have encompassed different styles of the flamenco style. You have the cante intermedio, the intermediate styles of songs. You have the cante hondo, the deep songs of flamenco, and then you have the cante chico, the light songs in the flamenco style. And, you know, pretty much they embrace the culture of the gitanos, the gypsies that have traveled through Spain, and of course the richness of influence from the, you know, continents and countries around mm-hmm. surrounding this incredible art form.
I think people are really familiar with the art form, the music part of it. We just heard Paco playing. The dance part of it, it's essential. It's all intertwined. You can't really split them apart. How did that come about, the idea that it's not just music, but it's dance as well?
One of the things is they celebrate so many different religious ceremonies throughout time. I mean, that's been something that, you know, many different types of tribes and cultures honor, you know, either their religious ceremonies or if they have a celebration. So the dance part is really intricate into, you know, the flamenco culture. And I think also that's really important is that the song, the letras, mm-hmm. tell a story. So if it is, you know, a happy celebration, you'll hear it in the songs that if they're talking about love. And then you also hear, if it's, you know, lamenting a loved one or a death or so, you'll also hear the cry in cante hondo songs yeah. like the Martinete Siguirilla or Solea Polvulerías. So the song tell the story, which, of course, the dancer portrays.
Paco, how did you get involved with flamenco?
Well, I was born in the flamenco scenery, I would say. I'm from Andalusia, where flamenco really come from. Since I was a kid, I was listening to it. And then when I was older, I started playing the guitar. I started playing more like a blues and rock, like all this music, the modern thing, you know, for us. But as soon as I saw some guitar, flamenco guitarists, I started studying it. And all of a sudden, I said, I know everything. Practically.
There's yeah. the guitar part, there's no doubt, but also your vocals. And yeah. they're so unique and so specific. Does that come from training to sing this way?
Not really. I never really thought myself as a singer. I always did the guitar, more the guitar. And then I start singing just like a, you know, like a parting. You start singing anywhere. And then they said, you sing all right. So let's go, you singer. You know, you are singer. I'm a singer and a guitarist, both. That is not very common in flamenco. Normally, in flamenco, you have a guitarist and you have a singer. But in my case, I do both.
You do both. Well, you're multi-talented, as we've learned before. It really is. Ensemble Español brings flamenco and flamenco passion to Chicago. And a lot of that has to do with Dame Libby Camacho, who passed away this year. This is a big deal for you guys. You had the tribute concert in April, and obviously Flamenco Passion will center around some of Dame Libby's work. How influential was she as someone who led this company and brought flamenco to Chicago?
Well, yeah, I think she was very instrumental. She had a passion and drive that was presented to her thanks to her mentor, Jose Greco, this incredible Italian immigrant, you know, working in Brooklyn, who falls in love with Spanish dance and introduces it to Dame Libby on one of his tours as he was looking for dancers here at the Palmer House in Chicago downtown. And I think Libby fell in love because of Jose Greco's presentation of not only the flamenco styles, but also the classical mm-hmm. dances of Spanish dance and the folkloric dances. And so that's one of the unique attributes that Ensemble presents and preserves are those styles of Spanish dance, classical, folklore, and flamenco. And then we also do it in the contemporary style. Her, as an American artist, you know, she brought in her musical theater background experience into the mix. And that, till today, became part of our mission. So we've got choreographers from not only Spain, but throughout the U.S., preserving the traditional dances, but then also incorporating some of the contemporary styles.
When you lose a founder and someone who has, like I said, so inspirational and had such a unique voice and presence. How hard is it for the ensemble to move forward? Because she was such a big part of it. Obviously, there's a lot going on, and it's not just her. But
as you recognize that she's no longer with you and the company has to move forward, how difficult is it? How much of a challenge is it?
I think because Dame Libby was fighting her lupus and Raynaud's syndrome diseases for some time now, I think she knew that she wanted Irma Suarez Ruiz, who is my right arm, who's been with the company 40 years of the 43-year history, and then myself for 35 years now. I think she knew that she would be leaving this legacy in her succession plan that she had. And so she wasted no time in making sure that we were part of that passionate world. I mean, we were lead dancers at one point. We were choreographers. We were teachers, not only for her youth company, but also in the community. And for me, she made sure that I knew all the administrative ends, working with our boards, committees, with our university, our grand partner, Northeastern Illinois University, who really provided this unique platform and residency, establishing scholarship endowments for our dancers to dance their way through college. And then, expanding that to start them off as young as 4 years old. We have dancers who started at the age of 4, 10, 12, 15, and are now principal dancers, helping us continue this legacy as lead dancers, rehearsal assistant, and choreographers and costume designers themselves. So I think that was the beauty in Libby. She really shared her incredible passion with anyone that came into her world. And this extended even into our international connections and friends like Juan Mata and Ana Gonzalez, founding members of the National Ballet of Spain, who've been with us since 1999. I mean, talk about, the best of the best.
The best.
And then, of course, artists like Paco Fonta, who have been with us from the very early ages. We've got Antonio Gabari Jimenez, the legendary Carmela Greco, daughter of Jose Greco, who has been coming to us for over 19 years. Paloma Gomez, Manolete. I mean, the list goes on. Over 90 artists have embraced the Ensemble Español. And again, that was part of Libby's legacy and mission. She wanted to bring authentic Spanish dance, and the way that she did that was embracing these incredible guest artists.
Before we hear another song, Paco, just as you see the work that goes into the ensemble and you see the festival continuing year after year in Chicago, are you encouraged and optimistic about the future of keeping this tradition alive, keeping flamenco and Spanish dance alive?
I think I'm very optimistic that the work that Jorge and Irma are doing, following what Libby taught them and taught us, me too, in some way she taught us, everybody. She was really very into teaching everybody and showing the right way to do the thing. I think that there is a big, big future, and we can see it. It's better and better.
Paco Fonta, it's great to see you again. To watch you play and to hear you is just it's tremendous. And I appreciate you coming back in and performing again. Jorge Perez is the executive director of Ensemble Español Spanish Dance Theater, which is at Northeastern University. All right, so the festival is going on right now, but Flamenco Passion is this weekend. And as we wrap up the segment, what are we going to hear here to take us out?
We're going to hear a wonderful Fandangos de Huelva from the province of Huelva. And it's actually one of the songs that we've had in our repertoire since 1976, when Dame Libby first started.
All right. Take it away.
Tu labio rojo que me dislocan como tus ojos, como tus ojos, que son ladrones que van robando los corazones. Y en el corral del consejo, con tus ojos me encontré. Y en el corral del consejo, cómo no me miraría, que de ti me enamoré. Para los restos de la vida, yo sé que tiene labio rojo, que me disloca como tus ojos, como tus ojos, que son ladrones que van robando los corazones. Que no hay nadita que ve, vuelva, no vuelva, señores, que no hay nadita que ver. Barco que allá había hizo la vela y se fue con la que yo más quería.
Fandango de Huelva.
That's going to do it for Extension 720 tonight. Mark Carmen in for Patty Vasquez. Good to see you, Mark. Always good to see Mark.
Always good to see you,
buddy?
Justin Coffin. I am doing great. I like this little tune you're playing here.
Yeah, no big deal.
Little vibe. little Wednesday night. I like it. Is it Wednesday night? Is it Tuesday?
It is Wednesday night.
It's Wednesday night.
It's a nice Wednesday night vibe. It's a vibe.
I mean, I feel like we're going to head on out and go to, what's that spot on Lawrence? I'll go over to the Green Mill right now.
Yeah, we could.
You know?
You got to do a show. Maybe after the show.
Every time
I see you, I think of the fact that, you know, you would be in the morning and then we would complain about the Bulls.
Yeah, they suck.
All winter long. And I see you in the minute I want. That's the first thing I want to do. They have no relevance whatsoever. And I'm like, hey, Carm's here. Let's complain about the Bulls.
You know who I talked to today? You might be minorly interested. Kobe White, point guard, North Carolina.
Yeah.
I think the Bulls won.
You think that could be a... I've seen Cam Reddish, but you think that this point guard out in North Carolina...
Cam Reddish is a...
Yeah, I get it. None of it's good.
He's an introvert. I interviewed Cam Reddish this week. And you shouldn't, by the way, pick a basketball player on how good they do interviews. But he would be so boring. Kobe White...
He's good. He's...
He had a lot of energy. He's got an interesting story. His father passed away when he was younger, and he's a point guard. He's got the huge 1970s afro going on. I would enjoy it.
Now, I've been thinking about you only for the fact that today is the anniversary of the 91 Bulls.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Yesterday was the anniversary of the flu game.
Right.
There's a lot of Bulls anniversaries in June. It doesn't matter what the years are. There's always going to be an anniversary in June of the Jordan years.
It is unbelievable. I love this time of year. The Shrug game was an anniversary, I think, last week. Game 1, 92 finals.
And frankly, and I will get to your show here, but the St. Louis Blues, watching them hoist the cup just made me just meh.
I'm gonna start with that, actually, yeah. and see if we can get some people to call in and congratulate St. Louis, and we'll send them a tape.
I don't know, man.
Yeah, I don't know if I can do it.
I don't know if I can do it.
Yeah.
Frankly, it makes me so angry because there was a point maybe three quarters way through the season that the Blues and the Blackhawks were jockeying for position. The Blackhawks could be the Blues. That's the point of making into the playoffs, that you could be the St. Louis Blues. And here they are up winning the Stanley. What else on the show tonight?
We got a lot going on here. The city of Chicago is coming after me, Justin.
Okay.
And
as they should.
And I talked about it last night. I was in, and and karma just came flying at me today. So that's going to be a thing.
Okay, good.
And I got thoughts on the women's soccer team celebrating up 13 zip. And I also have a real-life wedding crasher coming into the show. He'll be here after 11 o'clock. He Googled weddings this weekend, and he went over to the Hyatt with his roommate, and they did the wedding crash. The whole thing. In the pictures, at the end of it. I mean, sat down, had dinner. So I just think it's
admirable.
It's radio worthy. So
admirable.
Ethan Blumenthal's coming in after 11
o'clock. Always entertaining. Have a good show.
Thanks, Justin.